Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our topic today is the front page. Our topic today is an old black and white film with men in suspenders in a wooden office fighting for truth, justice, and the American way against insurmountable odds. You think I'm talking about a movie, don't you? Well, in a way I am, but I'm talking about something that sounds like it's out of a movie, something that happened right near WETS, right here in the mountains of central Appalachia, in the far western part of the state of North Carolina, in a place, I'll be honest with you, I had never heard of before I heard of this story, in a place called Yancey County. In Yancey County, there is a husband and wife team. Their name is Jonathan and Susan Austin. And Jonathan and Susan did something extraordinary. Well, they did several extraordinary things in just the last year or so. The first extraordinary thing they did was they started a newspaper. Yes, you heard me right. They started a newspaper. And that, for you younger listeners, that's, you know, actually a piece of paper with stuff written on it that, you know, you put news on it and people buy it and they read it. That's a newspaper, and those have been closing and reducing their runs all over the nation. There's a, you know, great shift going on in the way journalism is delivered to people, and newspapers have been failing all over the country. And so that was the first remarkable thing that Jonathan and Susan Austin did. But what brought them to my attention was that in their first year of operation in 2011, they won not one, but two national journalism awards that singled them out for their ethics and for their distinguished service to the First Amendment. Isn't that remarkable? A little small town newspaper. Well, what did they do? What's the story here? I'll let Jonathan and Susan tell you all about that. Well, Jonathan Austin, welcome to the show. Tell us what's happened down there in Yancey County.
Well, my wife and I knew we wanted to start a new newspaper for Yancey County, North Carolina. I've got deep roots, as does she, in the mountains of North Carolina. And I'm going on 30 years as a journalist. And we just had the opportunity to do what few people in journalism think is possible in this era. And that's, we started a brand new print edition weekly newspaper.
That is an extraordinary decision to make in this day and age.
Well, I think many people hear stories about negativity regarding newspapers, but I'm a firm believer that small communities must have a newspaper that comes out in print. No one else serves the small retailers, the small businesses, and the small communities as well as a newspaper that lives and breathes and interacts on a daily basis.
I'm getting this black and white impression of you wearing suspenders and a white shirt in a wooden office with big windows looking out on a Mayberry-esque sort of scene. Is that where you are?
Mayberry-esque, yes. I joke when I'm traveling and people say, how big is your paper? I always say, well, how big's your local football stadium? And they'll say, you know, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, 80,000. Our county population in its entirety could fit in one section. We wouldn't have enough people to do the wave. Suspenders, I've got suspenders. I wear them seldom. Bow ties, I've been known to wear bow ties.
Okay.
And just until recently, I'm 6 foot, almost 6 foot four, and I had a big Abe Lincoln beard, mainly for the intimidation factor of it.
All right. So you come to this Mayberry-esque little town in the mountains of western North Carolina. You start up a newspaper, and what happens?
I always think what we're doing is what you would call journalism 101. We're covering the basics. We're going to the government meetings. We're writing features. We cover agriculture. But in my very first edition, which came out January 13th, 2011, I noted what no other media in the county had bothered to note, which was that in 2010, every written absentee ballot that was cast in the general election had been seized by the state for a criminal investigation.
And no one else had reported this?
No. And there's another paper here. There's radio stations. No one. I had reported it when I had been at a neighboring county paper, just as a brief. And it had appeared in the Asheville Citizen Times. The brief I wrote appeared in the regional paper, but that was it. And people wondered, well, we had a record turnout of absentee ballots, and we're not talking one-stop voting here. That is counted as absentee balloting in North Carolina. I'm talking about the actual requesting a written ballot and it be mailed to you. We had more in Yancey County in 2010. We had, I think the number was 1,800 absentee mail-in ballots. This is in a county of fewer than 18,000 people.
Wow.
Five neighboring counties together had the same number of mail-in ballots for that election as we did here in Yancey.
And the state had seized them as part of a criminal investigation?
Yes. The state actually sent an investigator up from Raleigh. I don't think you could call him an investigator with arrest authority, but the State Board of Election does have an investigator. And he was here on election day watching. And in conversations with him, I think the best way to describe it is his jaw was dropping open, watching what he considered to be the highly questionable use of the ballot for, should we say, nefarious purposes.
Okay. Well, what happened? What did you find out was happening with this criminal investigation?
Well, I put one basic argument to the state. I said, if you had not seized all those absentee ballots, then I could walk across the street to the Board of Elections from my office, and I could say, I want to see those, they're public record. But since you've seized them and taken them 4 hours away to Raleigh, we're a very wide state geographically. Since you've taken them to Raleigh, you're hindering the public record access. So help me resolve this. And the state thought about it, the State Board of Election, and they said, you know what, you're right. They made copies, and it wasn't like they just bent over backwards saying, woohoo, sure, we'll help this guy. But in the end, they made copies of every public record regarding every individual absentee ballot application and provided them to me. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot in journalism and probably in your profession now about researching documents online and with computers and comparing data. This was very much a 19th century effort because I had all of these thousands of pieces of paper and I would spread them out on the living room floor to just try to go through and see if I could locate the issues that might have been the rationale for the investigation. Mm-hmm. And I quickly did. I quickly figured that out, what was happening. And it's a fine line. What was happening was there was a concerted effort to make sure people voted absentee. And, you know, that's not an issue. I truly do support aggressive politicking. But what I found was that law officers who worked for the sheriff were spending a lot of time circulating through the community, making sure that people voted. They were hand carrying ballots to people's homes. That's a crime. They were waiting around while the ballot was filled out. I don't know what happened during that. I haven't been able to find a voter who would say they were urged or not. But then they were witnessing the ballot. That's okay on balance. But then I had voters say, and then the deputy would take the completed ballot with them and take it to be cast. And that's a crime. State law is very specific in North Carolina. Likewise, even the application to receive an absentee ballot by mail, state law specifically says it must be filled out by the voter. The voter must be the one requesting it, or a family member for an incapacitated voter. Here in the county, too many of these, hundreds of these ballot applications were in the same handwriting.
So wait a minute. So somebody from the state, and perhaps deputy sheriff, perhaps someone else, shows up at people's houses and has filled out applications for absentee ballots that they're taking in, and they're bringing ballots to these people's houses and standing there while they fill them out?
Yes.
And then casting them for them?
Yes. Now, I cannot say they were filled out in advance. Mm-hmm. I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know the ballot was arriving, possibly unexpectedly. And that's, I think it comes down to, you know, you really like to focus on the Constitution, which is an admirable thing. None of this has anything to do with the federal Constitution per se, but it sure has something to do with the North Carolina Constitution, which mm-hmm. has very specific references to voting.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you should mention that, because one of the big issues left to the states in the federal Constitution is voting.
Yes. So, I like the way North Carolina did it. Here's mm-hmm. their entry in the North Carolina Constitution. All elections shall be free, period. End of sentence. Now, there are other sections of the Constitution which do address specifics, areas that I think there may be issues, but you'd be the better one to judge as to whether any of these issues arise to the federal constitutional level. But yes, deputies, here was my big fear, and I've never been able to resolve this.
Mm-hmm.
Were people wearing guns and badges showing up with ballots that were not expected and, quote, urging, end quote, voters to take part in the election? Was the urging, did it arise to the level of intimidation? You know, if someone shows up at your door with a badge and a gun, are those themselves ingredients of intimidation?
What was on the ballot that these deputy sheriffs seemed to be so interested in?
Their boss, his job.
The sheriff himself was running for re-election.
Yes, he had inherited the job from his father,
mm.
who, by the way, happened to have had inherited it from his father.
Mm.
Since he had inherited it in midterm, his father had retired. This was our sheriff's first run for office. And he had a strong opponent. He had a strong, well-qualified opponent. In the end, the sheriff won by 300 votes.
And how many absentees were there again?
1,800.
Okay. So that could
written in absentees.
Yeah, that could have easily provided the margin of victory then.
Absolutely. And what, you know, in any community, as America has gone through various issues regarding the vote, I think we can never feel like we've seen every attempt at perverting the vote. It's like a new product. Somebody will come up with something new. Well, this one probably isn't that new, but what better way to make sure you know how a ballot is cast than to be there when it's written out and to be the one to decide whether it shall go back and be counted? That's the other issue that comes to mind, is did some people vote in a way that maybe the message carrier, the ballot carrier, didn't like, and so did those ballots ever get counted?
Oh,
we'll never know that.
Yeah, that's another open question, isn't it? Well, what you apparently wrote about this in the newspaper. What happened then?
Well, my wife, who it's a two-person newspaper, literally a small effort. But my I remember one day my wife said that a priest came in and was describing life in the county prior to our arrival, and he quickly was in tears, and he put both hands on her shoulder and said, "You've got to be careful. They burn houses here."
Wow.
A retired field grade military officer First thing he said when he walked in the door was, if I get you body armor, will you wear it?
Wow.
People told us we should vary our route to work and back home every day. And many, many, many people said, get a gun. I'm a unique animal in the world of journalism. I spent 13 years in the Army Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
I feel comfortable watching my back. I feel comfortable watching my wife's, but of the two of us, she was the most nervous of these types of communications.
Okay, Susan Austin, thanks so much for joining us. Your husband tells us that during all of these travails that you have gone through in your first and very remarkable year at the Yancey County News, that he thought perhaps you were a little bit more nervous than he was about the physical threats that you all perceived.
Well, I guess if he felt that way, it is because our office is situated where he is in the back. And
so you're on the front line. I guess you would be a little bit more nervous then, wouldn't you?
I am on the front line, uh-huh. And in the beginning, I did have someone come in that I felt very threatened over, uh-huh. And he made some comments about Jonathan that I took as a direct threat.
Well, my goodness, may I ask what he said?
Basically that Jonathan would not be around very long to continue to print these stories.
Well.
But pretty direct, don't you think?
That certainly, I mean, I guess the tone of voice was important too, wasn't it?
It definitely was. Mm-hmm. And then after that happened, and folks had advised us to get the little handheld recorders. So I had presence of mind to grab mine and turn it on,
mm-hmm.
and kind of hide it behind some books on the staircase here. And so I did get the thing on record. Come to find out later on that afternoon that he was a retired police officer.
Oh,
so that didn't help matters either. We had that gentleman come in, also a retired local priest here, mm-hmm. came in and put each hand on each one of my shoulders and with tears in his eyes said to me, they burn houses in this county.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we've been speaking with Jonathan and Susan Austin, the owners and editors of the Yancey County News, which has just recently learned that it has won, not one, but two First Amendment awards. After the break, we'll have our Constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk some more with Jonathan and Susan Austin. Stay tuned.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet the politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore.
So excited! It's quiz time! Kelly's excited too. It's the Constitutional quiz, and here with me is Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier.
I'm always excited when you're excited.
I'm excited when you're excited. It's just a synergistic effect. There
is.
We are. All right. Do we have a contestant today for our quiz?
Yes, my name is Justin. I'm from Hazard, Kentucky.
Hazard, Kentucky. That sounds...
Hazard. Are there hazards in Hazard, Kentucky?
It sounds dangerous.
Do I need to be worried if I go through?
Yeah, I don't know. Have you ever met the Dukes?
No,
oh, that's bad.
I haven't.
I'm sorry. I'm sure that's the first time you've ever heard that question. I'm sorry. All righty. Well, Kelly, why don't you tell us? Give us a good constitutional quiz question for Justin.
All right, Justin. Here we go. In the United States, voting, serving on a jury, paying taxes, and obeying laws are A, guaranteed rights of citizenship, B, responsibilities of citizenship, C, requirements of citizenship, or D, benefits of citizenship.
Ooh, there's a civics type question, but it has.
I love my civics.
Well, you know, civics and constitutional law and constitutional history—they all overlap. But the constitutional angle is essentially what we're looking for is: are any of these either required by the Constitution, or are they rights guaranteed by the Constitution, or maybe are they simply good ideas? You know, we're looking for the ones that actually are either required. Well, we're looking for the correct statement is what we're looking for, right?
Absolutely.
So, okay, so let's go through them one by one for Justin, and he can comment on them. So what was this again?
A was guaranteed.
Well, first of all,
sure. In the United States, voting, serving on a jury, paying taxes, and obeying laws.
Okay, so voting, sitting on a jury,
paying taxes, and obeying laws.
Those four things. Now, what are those four things? Okay, what are our choices?
One is A, guaranteed rights of citizenship.
Is it my right to pay taxes? What do you think, Justin?
No, I don't think it is. And the reason I don't think it's your actual constitutional right is the voting. I know before until recently, you had to be at least 21 and a white male property owner, correct, before you could even vote?
Well, I can't answer your questions now. You have to answer the question. You're the guy who's doing the quiz.
Stuart will give us the classroom update after you answer it.
After you answer it.
He'll either tell you you're right or you're wrong and why.
We'll do that later. But, no, those are supposedly rights, according to answer choice A. And so the question is, do you think it's a right for me to obey the law? Is it a guaranteed right? A guaranteed right for me to pay taxes, a guaranteed right to do those other things?
No, I don't think it's a guaranteed right.
Okay.
All right, let's move on. So B, is it a responsibility of citizenship?
Are those four things a responsibility of citizenship?
That one's possible.
Okay, so
we'll go on to the next one.
We'll go on to the next one. What about C?
C, is it a requirement of citizenship?
No, I don't think it's a requirement.
It's not a requirement for me to pay taxes, obey laws. What are the other ones?
I don't think it's a requirement to vote.
To vote. Oh, okay. Okay. I see your point. So not C then. What about D then?
A D, benefit of citizenship.
Are those benefits of citizenship?
That one's possible too. I think I would go with B, as I don't think obeying laws and paying taxes are necessarily benefits to citizenship.
Not paying your taxes is not, that's not a benefit. I think that every year April 15th.
I feel so good when I pay taxes, and I love filling out the little forms.
It's a benefit of paying taxes when you get a tax refund, I think.
They didn't say tax refund.
Yeah,
okay.
No, I didn't say that.
All right, so you eliminate D, and your choice, if I understood you correctly, Justin, is choice B, right?
That is correct.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the quiz lady. What is
all right, saying? Justin, congratulations.
Hey, well done, Justin. You did a great job. That was exactly right, and you were able to differentiate between rights and responsibilities. And even though the Constitution doesn't specifically create a lot of responsibilities for citizenship, it's really more about rights. It's about powers of government in the first seven articles, then it's about rights in many of the amendments. It doesn't really talk to us about responsibilities, but it is our civic duty to pay taxes. It is our, you know, we don't like it, and we can argue about whether this tax or that tax is a good one or a bad one, but by and large, you know, you don't pay taxes, you don't have a government. It's our responsibility to obey laws. What were the other ones? To vote? Yeah, we're not required by the Constitution to vote, but it, you know, good citizenship, you know, strongly suggests that we should, and then cast informed vote. What was the other one?
Serving on a jury.
Serving on a jury. That's a very important responsibility too. In fact, that's extremely important constitutionally, not just because it's your civic duty, but because juries are a check on the power of the judiciary, and a very important concept that is. So, good job, Justin. Very interesting question, Kelly, and thanks everybody. It's your weekly Constitutional, where we're discussing the First Amendment, a free press, and a local newspaper, the Yancey County News from Yancey County, North Carolina, that has won some very big awards. How did such a little paper win such big awards? By exposing corruption in the local political machine.
all states have different ways of returning the right to vote to convicted felons. North Carolina has a very liberal method. Once you've performed everything the judge ordered you to do, you automatically regain your right to vote. But I documented and reported how felons who were still on probation were voting in this election. And one of them, after the story ran, one of them came to the office to complain. And we get great help from our son-in-law, Matthew Callback. I've got to do a call out to him. He's a former Marine who does all our distribution. And he was at the office that day when the gentleman came by to complain. And Matthew just called him on it and said, well, aren't you? Shouldn't you be ashamed? And he said the man just melted, just collapsed his argument, and immediately said, well, you know, if the deputy hadn't offered to take care of a traffic ticket for me, I wouldn't have voted. I like to say it sort of blew the lid off of a laissez-faire community. People who felt like it was good to have an aggressive newspaper in town were getting into verbal arguments in public with others who were just saying, I was here for one purpose, and that was to attack the status quo. I've been told that one downtown diner erupted in argument, one side of the room yelling at the other all about my stories. And let me tell you, that's one way to know you're having an effect.
They're not ignoring you.
They're not ignoring me.
Okay, so this apparently led to a series of articles. Were there any further revelations?
Well, in the midst of it, I uncovered how the chief deputy was stealing guns from the department, pawning them. Chief deputy in North Carolina is the number two in command. And by state law, if the sheriff left the job for whatever reason, the job automatically goes to that chief deputy. Later on, further decisions are made about a permanent interim sheriff, but the chief deputy is sort of like the vice president of the sheriff's department. The mantle falls to that person automatically. So he, North Carolina keeps records of all pawn transactions. And depending on which county attorney you speak to, they are considered public record or they are not. And I had one of each saying that from bordering counties. And the one that told me it was public record, I was able to go through their data and find where the chief deputy had a propensity of pawning firearms. I was also able to prove in Buncombe County, which is the county Asheville is located in, he was pawning department issued weapons.
So that was my next question. Wait a second. Now, so he's actually taking official government owned weapons and pawning.
Or as I put it, resident purchased, taxpayer purchased weapons.
Yeah, these are...
Oh, and deadly weapons, of course.
Well, that was my second question. Even whether they come from the government or whether these are weapons that have been seized, wherever they come from, these are dangerous weapons that are being put out on the street by someone who's supposedly interested in public safety.
Supposedly.
What happened to the deputy when this revelation came out?
The sheriff initially issued a statement about how he had been blindsided by this, and he asked the county to get him a private attorney. And the county's response was, and my response was, well, why do you need an attorney? Have you done something wrong?
The sheriff asked for a private attorney.
Yes.
Okay.
The county commission sent a certified letter to the district attorney in Boone, North Carolina, asking for an investigation. He resigned. That's all I can say as a matter of fact. He's never been arrested.
Excuse me, the deputy sheriff resigned?
Yes.
Okay, but the sheriff himself is still there?
Oh, yes.
And he's still in office?
Yes.
Any further revelations?
Yes.
Okay.
This is why it was a year-long investigation. I have had advertisers and retail establishments tell me, and I've had state investigators tell me that they were told that businesses have been warned to not advertise or sell my paper for fear of future repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
One business owner said she just couldn't deal with the hassle of selling 50 papers a week at the front counter. And my wife said, okay, well, that's fine. And as my wife was leaving, someone else ran out of the restaurant and knocked on her window, and she rolled it down, and they said, no, what you need to know is that someone came by and said that if we keep selling the paper, we will lose a county contract with the sheriff's department. It's interesting. I guess the best way to put it is what I did was in some way put an explosive device in the middle of a crack that had existed for years. And the explosive device just sundered much of the, as I said, laissez-faire attitude. People could not ignore it. They could attack it, but they could not ignore it.
When you say you've been warned by a number of well-intentioned people to watch your back, have you experienced any direct intimidation, or have you perhaps indirect?
A former law officer came into the office when my wife was there and said, so you're the new newspaper? And she said, yes. And he said, well, you won't be around long. Now, is that my wife chose to consider that intimidation? I tend to define intimidation through the eyes of the beholder. So therefore, yes, I define that as intimidation. We put a gate on our driveway. Our driveway is a couple of hundred yards long, as many are here in the mountains. And one night we came home and it was obvious that someone had driven around the gate through the woods. That was worrisome. But overall, no, you can have a very small supply of ink, but if your business is, what's the old joke, don't get into a fight with a newspaper man, they buy ink by the barrel load. Well, I think the way we approached it and the way we reported it, in some ways, I may be wrong, but in some ways immunized us, because I do have speed dial to the governor's office. I do have speed dial to law enforcement throughout the region and throughout the nation. I feel like if anything bad happened to us, the repercussions would not be pleasant.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of the situation of a lot of these freedom fighters and civil rights activists and repressive regimes around the globe. I mean, the reason that they're tolerated is because if they disappeared suddenly, the governments in question would come under a great deal of criticism. So maybe that's the same sort of phenomenon that's protecting you.
And speaking of the freedom riders and the individuals who came down to assist in the voting work in, say, Mississippi, initially they may have been treated badly or killed, but I think the immediate overwhelming response the federal government had to that, flooding the area with FBI agents, may have taught them a lesson.
It's your weekly Constitutional. We've been talking with Susan and with Jonathan Austin from the Yancey County News about their remarkable first year and the awards that they won during that first year publishing their newspaper. Next, let's have the Madison Minute, and then we'll take a little break. After we come back from our break, we'll do This Week at Montpelier, and then we'll talk to some people about the particular awards the Austins have won. We'll talk with Tim Gleason from the University of Oregon, and we'll talk with Sue Porter from the E.W. Scripps Foundation. Stay tuned.
Paul Jennings was a slave at Montpelier. One of Paul Jennings' duties was to accompany the retired James Madison wherever he went. This meant that Jennings met his counterparts at the various plantations to which they traveled. This may well have been the way in which he had the opportunity to meet and court his future wife, Fanny Gordon. But despite having the consent of their respective masters, the couple did not initially live together. Montpelier was an hour's walk from where Fanny lived, so it is likely that Jennings only traveled to see her once weekly, probably on Saturday evening, so that they could spend all of Sunday together. Traditionally, slaves did not work on Sundays. Paul and Fanny's marriage persisted despite these challenges and produced several children. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
I'm here to shout it, read all about it, get your morning paper. Read about the man who murdered his rival to get in the electric chair. Read about a country's fight for survival. Read about the county fair.
X-ray, buy a paper from me.
Well, Kelly Carmichael, I bet, I'm just going to guess that she's going to tell me what's happening this week at Montpelier.
Yeah, we have a new exciting tour, kind of a VIP experience for folks to come to our sunset tours of Montpelier.
Oh, man, I can just see it.
Sitting on the steps of James and Dolly Madison's home, looking at the Blue Ridge Mountains.
That
14 miles away.
That, you know, and the thing is, on a clear day, I bet that would just be... I have not seen a sunset from the front porch. That
really
would be spectacular.
Yeah, it's really spectacular. It's worth going and joining our Facebook pages, either Montpelier or Center for the Constitution Facebook pages, because throughout the summer we always post photos when the staff is enjoying it.
What does one have to do to become a VIP?
Well, go to montpelier.org so you can get a ticket, and the tour itself will include after-hours lecture of the Constitution and the House, wine and cheese reception, the sunset tour, all with some of our Montpelier executive team.
I see. That absolutely sounds wonderful. And is wine included?
There is wine included.
There is wine.
So I know you'll be there.
I would definitely like to be there. That's tremendous. And so there's a constitutional aspect of this. There's the tour itself. And then there's just the enjoyment. Tremendous. Now, if it rains and you can't see the sunset, so you get a refund, right?
I don't know about that. You'll have to go to montpelier.org for the fine print.
I see.
But I tell you one thing. Even when it's raining, it is still a squirrel's leap from heaven at Montpelier.
A squirrel's leap from heaven at Montpelier. So go to montpelier.org or center.montpelier.org, and you can get information on these things. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with Jonathan and Susan Austin of the Yancey County News, who in their first year of operation in a little bitty paper in a little bitty town in North Carolina, won a couple of very big awards. Well, I had the opportunity recently to speak to the people who were in charge of those awards. The first person I spoke with was Sue Porter from the Scripps Howard Foundation.
I am Vice President of Programs for the Scripps Howard Foundation and administrator of our Scripps Howard Awards. It's a national journalism awards program that's been going on for decades.
Tell us about these awards.
It's a national journalism awards program, so it's open to all media in the United States. And we have 15 categories. They range from, First Amendment, business, human interest writing, photojournalism, just a whole group of them, that investigative reporting, that cover what journalists do on a daily basis. We just want to honor outstanding work.
Well, the one we're particularly interested in today is the award, I think it's called the Distinguished Service to the First Amendment. Is that the title of the award?
Yes. And it's really the award that we hold in highest esteem because it's named for the founder of the E.W. Scripps Company. E.W. Scripps, he founded our company more than 130 years ago.
So this was the big one. This was the big enchilada.
Well, we think every one of our awards are important.
Well, what are the criteria for the Distinguished Service to the First Amendment Award?
This category honors an individual or an organization for distinguished service in the cause of First Amendment guarantee of a free press.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this can be limited to fighting the threat of censorship in America or overcoming public uneasiness with regard to press credibility. I mean, it could be combating government secrecy at all levels, or perhaps instilling in the public an appreciation of its need as well as its right to know, as guaranteed by the First Amendment.
Why did the Yancey County Press win the award for 2011?
They were clearly the best.
Clearly the best. Well, that's quite a statement. Well, what in particular did they do that impressed you all?
The judges particularly liked the courage shown by Jonathan and Susan Austin. And they love the fact that they did the work with their own personal sacrifice was involved. And in this case, their entry just demonstrated what can happen when you have a free press and when you have freedom of speech in the hands of people who are responsible, resourceful, hardworking, and courageous.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been talking with Sue Porter from the E.W. Scripps Foundation about one of two major journalism awards won by the Yancey County News. Now let's talk to Tim Gleason from the University of Oregon, who's going to tell us about the second major award.
Well, I'm the dean of the School of Journalism and Communication at the University of Oregon, and we are the home of the Ansel Payne Awards for Excellence in Journalism.
Well, who was Ansel Payne, and why is this award named after him?
Ansel was a broadcast executive here in the Northwest, in Portland and in Seattle, and he was a very strong advocate for the First Amendment and for free speech and for good journalism, and he wanted to establish an award that would be an exemplar for young journalists, especially as they enter the field. And the award is intended to honor not just good journalism, but people who, in the face of significant economic or political pressures, make good ethical decisions. They're not always decisions that we agree with, that is, the selection committee agrees with, but they're decisions that are made thoughtfully and, again, in the face of pressures that could, they could very easily do something else.
Who else is on the selection committee, if I may ask?
Well, the selection committee is made up of journalists and academics from this university and then from around the country.
Why in particular did the Yancey County Press and Jonathan and Susan Austin, why did they win it for 2011, right?
Right. The Austins did something that very few people are doing in this day and age, which is they started a newspaper, and that in and of itself was certainly a brave step on their part.
Yes, it was. You might want to develop a new award just for people who are willing to start newspapers these days. Yeah,
right. But they won the award because literally with beginning with the first issue of the newspaper, they began to do serious journalism in their county and quickly discovered that there were some very questionable practices going on, especially as it pertained to the sheriff's department. And so their reporting on these activities, which in one instance had to do with county firearms being pawned, and then the second instance
wow.
with voter fraud, they kept on these stories even as their advertisers were beginning to be threatened, and people were basically being told, you'd better not keep advertising with these folks. And so even in the face of those kinds of pressures that really threatened the actual existence of their newspaper, they not only kept on reporting, but they did very solid reporting, very careful reporting. The reporting itself was nothing other than just very good reporting. But the fact that they did it in this and made decisions along the way to continue pursuing these stories because they believed the public needed to know this information, even in the face of threats to their very existence, we found that to be an extraordinary example of ethical journalism done in the face of significant pressure. And I might note that this is an award that has been won over the years by major publications, the New York Times and others, as well as small newspapers and other small news organizations. So we were very thrilled to be able to honor this great work.
Very impressive. Now, how did such a small newspaper come to your attention? Is there a nomination process?
Well, there is a nomination process. We have what we kind of call scouts around the country who are on the lookout throughout the year for potential nominees. And then also we do a fair amount of monitoring of what's going on in journalism across the country and seek out nominations as well. I might note that we're not the only organization that has honored the Austins. They won a Scripps Howard Award just several months ago as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you had the pleasure of actually meeting Jonathan and Susan?
No. I have. They came out. We made the award last month, and they came out to accept the award and to spend a day or 2 days in classes with students, sharing their story and just talking about their vision of good journalism and the future of journalism.
That's a very interesting question, the future of journalism, since you are the dean of the journalism school. I guess you think journalism does have a future, despite all the naysayers.
Well, there's no question that journalism has a future. There's never been greater demand for or need for good journalism, good fact-based reporting and commentary. What the current challenge is not the demand for journalism, it's a business model to support journalism. As I will tell our nearly 450 graduates in a week or so, they are at an extraordinary moment in history. These students, I mean, these young journalists, are going to be the ones who redefine the field. I have no doubt as to the future. I also have no doubt that it's going to be difficult getting there.
Well, the Austins seem to have found their model, and you seem to be very impressed by what they've done. So we thank you very much, Tim Gleason, of the University of Oregon, for talking to us about the Ansel Payne Award. Thank you, and go Mighty Ducks.
Yes, indeed.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we've been talking with representatives of the E.W. Scripps Foundation and the University of Oregon, both of which have given awards to Susan and Jonathan Austin, the publishers, the editors, the owners of the Yancey County News. Last time we spoke to Susan, she told us about, you know, how difficult it was and how very frightening it was sometimes, even feeling as if she were concerned about her personal safety.
We have moved on. We have persevered. I don't feel that way too much any longer because our story is out there, and truly, if something were to happen to us, then we believe that everyone would know where it generated from.
Yeah, perhaps it provides you with a bit of insurance then. Well, did it ever occur to you that maybe you should just fold up your tent and leave town? I mean, this sounds like a frightening experience, and certainly, you know, it's a brand new business. There was the economic issue as well. Did you ever just feel like quitting?
Not at all.
Never?
Not even in the least.
Well.
Not at all.
Now, why were you so determined?
Because this community has been stifled for so many years, and our mission statement is to be a voice and to allow the voices of our community to be heard. Both of us, being Asheville natives, grew up coming up to this community. We both had family here and knew about this wonderful place, but didn't really understand why it had never grown into something more modern.
Mm-hmm.
Change is on the way. They are widening 19 here, and change is on the way, and with our stories that we are reporting on, which are factual, we believe that we are providing a point of change where growth can occur. So, no. My husband, being the journalist for his entire career, is fearless. And I support that. And I believe in what we're doing and believe that we are going to make a difference here.
It's your weekly Constitutional. We've been talking with Susan Austin about her experiences at the Yancey County News. Let's talk to her partner and husband now, Jonathan Austin. He's going to tell us about the actual experience of winning these remarkable National Journalism Awards.
I don't know about that word, distinguished. My father, who lived to be 94, won what they call the Distinguished Flying Medal for service in World War II for 50 missions in a bomber over Europe. That's distinguished. He went on to a great career as a social worker in the mountains here in Western North Carolina and helped convince the state to build an alcohol treatment center in the western part of the state. That's distinguished. I accept the award, and I'm honored by it, and I'm humbled. If what I did was distinguished in their eyes, I thank them for it, and I hope it helps people understand that good journalism doesn't just exist in big metro areas. Sometimes it exists in a town of 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
We received that award, and then on the heels of that, the University of Oregon awarded us the Ansel Payne Award for Ethics in Journalism.
Mm.
And last year's winner of that was the New York Times.
You are beating up on some of the big boys in the journalism field. That is very impressive company that you're keeping.
I like to say we're in high cotton.
Well, you've had a heck of a first year for the Yancey County News. What are your plans for your second year?
The thing I enjoy the most is, yes, I may be a publisher and a newspaper editor. What I enjoy is stalking the sidelines at our football games with a really big Nikon camera taking extraordinary action photos. I enjoy the small parts of journalism. I enjoy writing a good feature. I enjoy helping the community remember a loved one who's passed. I enjoy the minutiae of journalism. Reporting that Mrs. Smith grew a really giant tomato. That's what I consider consistent and successful and community-oriented journalism. When you tell your residents of things that do affect them on a constant basis. All this other stuff, it's abnormal journalism, because the fact that it had been so unreported meant for me it was sitting there, just like, you know, it's the equivalent of walking down the street and you find a $100,000 bill, you know. But it was great journalism. What do I plan to do? I plan to just keep chugging along. Sometimes the engine will knock. Sometimes the front page won't be very dramatic, but it will always be information that I think our county needs to know.
Well, that was just a fascinating tale, wasn't it? You know, James Madison once said that, and I'm quoting here, "To the press alone, checkered as it is with abuses, the world is indebted for all the triumphs which have been gained by reason and humanity over error and oppression." In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the First Amendment is important, the press is important, and without a free press, free government is awfully difficult. So thanks very much to Jonathan and Susan Austin of the Yancey County News, and to, of course, the representatives of the awarding organizations, Tim Gleason and Sue Porter, for talking to us today about that. And then a little bit of time that remains to us, let's have a bit of a change of pace. There was a sad occasion recently. A very prominent federal judge passed away recently, and I happened across his obituary in the New York Times, and happened to know someone who knew the judge and who's going to tell us all about him, because this judge, he was a remarkable fellow. Ken Trujillo, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Now, I understand that you know all about Judge Lewis H. Pollack, who recently passed away.
Well, I don't know about all about him, but I do know him, and I had some terrific experiences with him in a variety of circumstances. Probably my most memorable, at least, would be when I was an assistant U.S. attorney. I had the opportunity to appear before him on a number of occasions and hearings and trials and a whole host of proceedings.
Now, an assistant U.S. attorney prosecutes federal crime, right?
Correct.
Okay. And, so you were in there as a prosecutor?
Correct.
In Philadelphia. Okay.
Exactly. And so there's several things that really distinguished that Judge Pollack. Number one, his intellect. He clearly was one of the brightest minds on the bench. And just absolutely intent on being fair, both and fair to the parties and to counsel and to everyone. Many judges have large egos, and
say it isn't so.
he was not one of them. One of the amazing things about him is that he's the only judge I've ever seen do this. Is he would come down, and regardless of whether you were a criminal defendant or a civil plaintiff or anything else, he would come down from the bench, shake the hands of the lawyers and the parties.
I have never seen a judge do that.
Absolutely. Every single time that I would go into his courtroom, he would come down from the top and would shake hands with every party. And I, like I said, the criminal defendants sometimes were in shackles.
Wow!
And he would come down, and they would be shocked, particularly if they'd been in front of judges before. So he was one of the most gentle kind human beings that you can imagine. So this combination of a force of nature from an intellectual standpoint, really a legal giant, but just one of the most courteous and kind men that you can imagine meeting. So that he was an absolute pleasure to appear in front of.
Now, as a prosecutor, of course, you were probably hoping for a hanging judge sometimes. Did that ever get in the way? Did his kindness ever interfere with his giving appropriate sentences?
I don't think it did. He clearly would give both counsel and the defendant the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody was likely to believe a story, I think it's fair to say that prosecutors would generally not favor him for a sentencing if they really wanted to put somebody away.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, he was and understood that he was bound by the laws and by the sentencing guidelines and the like, and so he did not hesitate, to do what he needed to do. And so, if somebody deserved harsh treatment, he would do that. But by the same token, he would give people the benefit of the doubt.
Well, did you ever have any other dealings with him? Because that was some years ago when you were a federal prosecutor, if I recall. That was back in the 80s or 90s.
My other interactions with him were both as a law professor when he was dean of the Penn Law School years ago. But then he and I interacted during some. I also teach at Penn Law School, so mm-hmm. we would interact, and I had to bounce some ideas of.
That's the University of Pennsylvania. That's one of the best law schools in the country.
Well, I graduated from there, so I think so.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Yes, okay, all right.
I think you would.
And they've been letting you teach over there.
I know. The standards are really going down.
They must be, okay. But you actually saw him as a colleague then over teaching at Penn.
Correct. And then also, he lives actually in the neighborhood next to mine. And so whether he was catching the bus or walking along the street, I would come into contact with him. I would say not often, but it was not unusual to run into him on the street.
Now, that's another shocking thing. I don't know of any other federal judge who's ever set foot on a bus.
He was, just an incredibly humble man. The other interaction we had, he would sit on the Third Circuit by designation. And so on several cases that we had in the civil context of my firm, he was actually a judge sitting on the panel. And of course, he's somebody who would have been very at home on the U.S. Supreme Court, and so he was obviously an able appellate judge as well.
Well, I do know one thing that predated your association with Judge Pollack was, of course, his extraordinary contribution to the desegregation case, Brown versus Board of Education. Did he ever talk to you about that, or was that ever something, a subject that came up among your colleagues in Philadelphia?
No, I did not talk to him about that. That was he was a couple years older than me. I think he really was a judge's judge, and I think it's a great loss for Philadelphia and for the country because he's really a giant. And like I said, I think the most unique aspect of that is he was a man who was one of the most accomplished jurists in our history, but yet was also one of the most gentle and kindest people you would ever meet, and that's my memory of him.
And a very good memory it is. Well, Ken Trujillo of Trujillo, Rodriguez, and Richards, LLC in Philadelphia, thank you so very much for your time, and we'll have to call you again next time something significant happens up in Philadelphia.
All right, Stuart, my pleasure.
And that's our show for the day. Thanks very much to my good friend Ken Trujillo for talking to us about Judge Lewis Pollack. Thanks very much to Jonathan and Susan Austin of the Yancey County News for talking to us about their remarkable journalism awards. Thanks very much to Tim Gleason of the University of Oregon for talking to us about his Ansel Payne Award from the University of Oregon School of Journalism. And thanks also, of course, to Sue Porter from the E.W. Scripps Foundation for talking to us about their First Amendment Award. My executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.